Accession number 7325, Real One.
Colonel Legg, Real One. When were you born?
I was born in Cheltenham in 1916.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a businessman, but he was also in the Royal Naval Reserve, and therefore he served with the Royal Navy during the First World War.
Where were you educated?
I was educated at Eton, and in the Royal Military College, as it was called in those days, at Sandhurst.
Why did you decide to go in for the army?
Mainly, I think, because I was a younger son, and at that time, there was still the Victorian or Edwardian view of sending at least one son into either the Navy or the Army. And I hadn't a particular interest in any business, nor had my father got the influence in business to start me off. So that's why I went to the Army. And I wouldn't say that I was necessarily had the vocation for going to the Army at the start, but it grew on me.
When were you at Sandhurst?
I was there from 1934 till the end of 1935.
And which particular unit did you go into?
I then joined the Royal Fusiliers, which is the City of London Regiment.
Any particular reason?
Yes. The Royal Fusiliers had been raised by an ancestor of mine, in fact, I don't know how many grandfathers ago, in 1685 at the Tower of London. Someone called George Legg had done it.
Now, can we go on to the declaration of war, and can you recollect what people round about you and you yourself thought when Chamberlain declared that we were at war with Germany?
Yes. I think you've got to remember that from the period in 1938, when there was the Sudeten crisis, that we were getting so used to crises having taking place almost every month, right through the end of 38 and through 1939, that when it came, it didn't come as any sort of shock at all. I remember someone saying, oh, by the way, we're at war. The other point I'd like to make, of course, I was in India then with the foreign battalion. There were two battalions, the Royal Fusiliers, as there were with all infantry regiments, one of which was abroad, and the other one at home, which was the system prior to 1939. And I was with the 1st Battalion in India. And therefore, of course, we were very far away from European politics and European crises. But nevertheless, it had very little impact on us at all, except that you suddenly find yourself becoming, being put on a war footing, having been preparing for that for very, very nearly 12 months.
Did people welcome the war declaration or not?
Not much, in my experience.
Why not?
Well, one of the reasons was, and this is, again, parochial, it so happened that when the 1914-18 war started, there was a battalion of the Royal Fusiliers in India then. It was stationed somewhere just outside Calcutta. And of the 36 officers and about 850 men, only about 7 officers and about 150 men survived the war. And this we very well knew. And we felt, well, if this is going to be another war, who's going to get through this one? So that it wasn't a thing we particularly welcomed.
Had you thought that it might be a similar type of war to the First World War?
Yes, because we knew no better. We couldn't see anything that was going to take place other than what had taken place in the past.
Now, how was it that you got to East Africa?
Well, my regiment was in a Indian brigade, and I must explain the point that in India, the British Army was superimposed on the Indian Army so that it was completely integrated. And the form was that you had a brigade of one English regiment, one British regiment, and two Indian infantry regiments. And then there was usually a British gunner regiment and perhaps an Indian sapper regiment or something like that. But the point was there was always this one-third, two-thirds ratio. Now, we were stationed in the Jhansi Brigade at a place called Jhansi in central, what was in there, the central provinces of India, which is the center of northern India. Now, the Jhansi Brigade was the first reserve in India to go anywhere if there was a crisis. It was known as the Fire Brigade as a result of that. That meant that if even there was a small minor crisis up on the northwest frontier or somewhere else, the Jhansi Brigade would be called upon if it was necessary, if the local troops couldn't deal with it. So we knew that if the war came, we'd go just like that. And we did. The war was declared on September the 3rd, and we were at Bombay on the high seas within 7 days.
Did you manage to take all your equipment with you?
Military equipment?
Yes.
Not really. Another point to remember is that up to 1939, the British regiments in India had mule transport, and they had practically no MT, as it was called. Of course, all the mules were left behind, and it wasn't until we got to Egypt that we, in fact, got mechanized, that is, got the amount of mechanical transport that a infantry battalion would have if it had been in Europe, and also a carrier platoon. The other thing was that we were at that, up to that time, we using a very obsolete machine gun, light machine gun called a Vickers Berthier, yeah, which was the issue machine gun, the light machine gun, to the Indian forces in India, not the Indian Army only. That was left behind, and we got given the Bren gun when we got to Egypt. So the answer to your question in two words is that we left most of our equipment behind, except for hand arms.
How did you find that the Bren compared with the Vickers Berthier?
Oh, miserably superior. The Vickers Berthier was extremely difficult gun to fire, mainly because it had a rocking motion, which meant that you had to hold it with a sort of finger and thumb only as it was firing. Otherwise, it would jump away off the target. Whereas a Bren, you can lock it into your shoulder and hold it firmly and just pull the trigger and the bullets will go straight.
Were there any disadvantages to the Bren?
None, really, bearing in mind that it was the first time that the British Army had been armed with an automatic weapon which had very few stoppages. By that I mean things that can go wrong with it. For instance, if you go back to the old Lewis gun, which is what my 2nd Battalion in the United Kingdom had when I first joined in 1936, that had what they call 22 stoppages, which means that 22 things could go wrong at any one time. Whereas I think the Bren gun only has about three, or had only about three. So it was a great advance.
Was there any equipment which you felt that you should have had in being taken to East Africa that you were lacking?
Not really, because, of course, one couldn't foresee the development of equipment. One of the points I've noted here is that we were really very ill-equipped down there. And, of course, when I say down there, in the whole of North Africa, and we were in Egypt and, of course, North Africa and elsewhere, we were very, 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 very ill-equipped for the first few years of the war, because basically there was only the rifle. It was the old Lee Enfield rifle, which was rather heavy, and the long bayonet. Then there was the Bren gun, and that was all, really. We had some 3-inch mortars and a carrier platoon, which you stuck the Bren gun out of, but those were only very small units within a large battalion. And we hadn't got to the days when we had these things like Sten guns or other very light automatic weapons, which practically everybody would carry if they weren't carrying a rifle. And we certainly hadn't got to the days when we had proper communications. I mean, the communications in North Africa, and particularly in East Africa, were quite unbelievably simple. all they consisted of within a battalion was either telephone lines or visual signals by flags or even by heliograph, which is something which you think about when you think about television on the Northwest frontier in the 19th century. And there was no radio communication within the battalion whatever. There was one radio link, and a very cumbersome one, between battalion headquarters and brigade headquarters. Now, the effect of that was that once a commanding officer had given orders to his companies in an attack to go into action, he rarely lost control of them completely until they were on the objective. From the point of view of the company command, it was the last moment in military history when the company commanders rarely had an independent command and had to fight the battle in their own way. After that, and of course gradually as the war progressed, you had communications by radio right down to platoons, and no commander could do anything without having to come up on the air and say what he was doing and ask for permission. This was perhaps a good thing and a bad thing.
I was going to say, was that regretted by the junior officers, do you think?
Well, I regretted it tremendously later on in the war when I had to, I had radio linked to my CO. I thought he was a marvellous command. I was a company commander at that time, and I thought he was a marvellous command to be able to, you get your orders, then you had to go off and really just the same as in the Great War, except that you, it was a much more mobile war. You had to go and carry out your, the operation, and you were the boss, and eventually you had to send perhaps a runner back with a message written out, or a verbal message, to say what was happening.
What about the strength of the battalion? Was it up to strength?
It was up to strength, yes, at the beginning of the war. The point there is that it was the British system that, for the infantry, that the battalions at home, in our case, our 2nd Battalion, the Royal Fusiliers, had to keep their foreign battalion, the 1st Battalion, up to strength. And so all British infantry battalions abroad, particularly in India, were 100% up to strength, both in officers and men. Whereas at home, the battalions were very under strength, perhaps 50% strength in peacetime. Now, the advantage of that from the point of view of the Royal Fusiliers in the beginning of the war was that, first of all, we were up to strength anyway, and everybody knew each other. And the second thing was that, of course, we were 100% regular troops. And that was true of practically every unit in the Middle East until about the end of 1941, by which time casualties had taken such a toll that we were, so to speak, adulterated. I hate to use that term because they were very, very fine reinforcements, but we were adulterated by people who had not been in the army before the war and were less well-trained.
What about the attitude of you and your brother officers towards the necessity for fighting in East Africa?
What, as opposed to fighting in North Africa?
Yes.
Well, the other point that was very noticeable at the beginning of the war, it was before the days of Monte. Nobody really knew what the hell was going on. And you just went where you were sent. And in most cases, you didn't know why you went there. Now, in the case of my regiment, we were in the desert, not very far from Cairo, facing the Italians during 1940. And then my regiment took part in the very first battle in that area, the Battle of Sidi Barrani. And, of course, one knows now, looking back on it, that the whole strategy was to use these regular units, the regular divisions, to smash the enemy in various places, take them out quickly, then move them to another area, and then smash them there, and then take them out again and smash them somewhere else. You see, that was Wavell's strategy. He hadn't got enough troops otherwise to do it. And therefore, we expected to be moved a lot, and we rather liked it because we never got to the stage when one must have done in trench warfare or static warfare, when one was dreading the routine of it.
But what I was getting at was why was it thought necessary to have a campaign of hostilities against the Italians in East Africa? What was the point of view of the junior officer at that time?
Well, I'm not absolutely certain they had a point of view, but I feel that I and they must have known that there was a threat to places like the Sudan and Kenya from Eritrea and what was then known as Abyssinia, and that in order to make quite certain that the forces in North Africa were free to operate without any sort of threat to their rear, it was necessary to send down quite a large force to deal with that once and for all. We'd already had the example of losing British Somaliland to the Italians because there literally weren't any troops there, or practically no troops.
Speaking generally about the presence of British troops in both North and East Africa,
yes,
was it ever questioned amongst the officers in your unit as to why you should be in Africa rather than in Britain when there was a threat to the British Isles themselves?
Not at first, no. The feeling was that that was where we'd been sent and that's where we got to like it. And there were plenty of troops with reserves in the United Kingdom, and they moved gradually across to France as they were formed up into divisions to become the British Expeditionary Force. And then, of course, that was followed by what is colloquially described as the phony war. So we didn't really feel there was any threat there at all much. In fact, we felt that there was a bigger threat to our lines of communication throughout the world, particularly the Suez Canal, in the Middle East in the early days. Well, then, of course, when the German attack took place in Belgium and France and things went from bad to worse, of course, it was then too late for us to go back and help. We were up against it anyway in the Middle East.
Now, how did you get to East Africa?
Well, before I was in fact an instructor for a few months at a military tactical school in Cairo. And as I mentioned earlier, my regiment took part in the Battle of Sidi Barrani in the beginning of December and was immediately pulled out with the rest of the 4th Indian Division, which is what the formation we were in. And the battalion concentrated in a desert camp outside Cairo at Mina, and I joined them there on or about Boxing Day in 1940. We then moved from there as a battalion with transport and everything by train from Cairo to Aswan, and we detrained there because that's as far as the railway ran. May I point out, of course, that was before the big dam was built now, and therefore the Nile continued beyond that point. The next thing that happened was that the whole battalion, less its transport, were embarked on river steamers, these paddle steamers. The transport drove across the desert, where the Nile makes a big loop, straight across the desert, to Wadi Halfa, and the rest of the battalion moved by river steamer to Wadi Halfa. That would be between about the 1st and the 10th of January 1941. When we got to Wadi Halfa, we were rejoined by our battalion transport and then got onto a train there, because that's where the Sudan railways extend to in the north. And we then went by train all the way from there through Khartoum, through a place called Wad Medine. I remember that particularly because the local British people there came and, I think they were something to do with cotton growing, they came and produced some welfare food and stuff for us when the train stopped there. Eventually to a place called Gedarev. In other words, we did a loop down through Khartoum, southwards. Then we bore away eastwards. And eventually we turned north to Gedarev. I can show you that probably on the map.
Was the journey a comfortable one or not?
It was a comfortable one from the officer's point of view. I think it was pretty hard on the troops, particularly on the train. They didn't get... they were just sitting in the train day and night. They didn't get anywhere to lie down except on the floor.
What's happened when you got to Gedarev?
Well, then we detrained there and literally lived in the open, in the bush country near Gedarev, for a period of days. Again, so far as we were concerned, there was a complete fog of war. I mean, we didn't know where we were going or even why we were there. So the time was spent in training the men in operating in that type of country, because you've got to remember that for the past year we'd been in the desert, which is quite different.
What was the character of the country around there?
Undulating, very rocky, sparse vegetation, stunted trees, a typical sort of East African countryside.
And what were the problems for training in the area?
Well, the real problem was that you were entirely dependent on marching and being physically fit to carry everything everywhere, because the countryside was so broken and rocky that you couldn't really get transport off the roads very much. And of course the roads were like dust tracks, but there weren't very many of those. So that one had to train to be as independent as one could of any mechanized transport at all.
What about the climate? Did that present real problems for you?
No, it was dry. It was the dry season, and it was fairly hot. I don't think that time we noticed how hot it was going to become. This was early January, but it was pleasantly warm. But again, you've got to remember that basically nearly everyone in the regiment had spent some years in India. And we were used to a tropical climate, and we were used to the sun. We had the right clothing, and therefore I think that had little or no effect. It did later on, but that was for really other reasons.
What did the clothing consist of?
Well, the clothing in those days was very basic. You know, that each officer and soldier wore a shirt and shorts, and what we called hose tops, with putties round the boots. And then we were still at that time wearing topis, which we had brought all the way from India.
Did you find this clothing suitable for your purposes?
On the whole, yes. The advantage of shorts, if you're operating in mountainous country, and of course gradually it became more and more mountainous, is you have considerable freedom of movement as far as your legs are concerned. The disadvantage is that if you graze your knees, which is very easy to do, you are laying yourself wide open to the thing becoming septic. And this is, of course, what did happen in a very big way later on.
How is it treated?
What, the actual...
The saw.
Well, the real problem there, which I'm going to mention later on, was that the rations were very poor in those days in the army. This wasn't just that campaign, but rations were extremely poor. And they contained little or no fresh vegetables or fruit. And for some time, including being in the desert, everybody had become very susceptible to sores. It was a lack of vitamin C. The well-known expression, which probably is never used now, but it was used widely in the Middle East for some years, was getting a desert sore. But, of course, you've got a sore anywhere in that part of the world. You only got to scratch yourself on a thorn bush or a rock in East Africa and it would go bad. Now, why the powers that be didn't make some supreme effort to issue us with ascorbic tablets, I don't know. We did get those occasionally, but we should have had them every day, because there was a lot of sickness later on because of that.
But once someone had got a sore, how was it treated?
Well, basically, I'm not certain what the medical treatment was, but something was put on it, and it was then bandaged. And, of course, you constantly saw men with all their knees bandaged, which, again, was an unsatisfactory way of doing it, because it was hot and dusty, and the thing was to rub. Whereas what you really wanted to do is rather like the use of antibiotics. You wanted to cure it from the inside outwards.
So an ointment was put on it.
An ointment was put on it, yes.
Were there any other problems with health?
No, I don't think so. I think everybody was very fit, both before and during the whole campaign. But as I said before, there was this one failing, and that is that there was a great deal of unfitness through getting these sores and things going septic.
There was no malaria or intestinal complaints?
I don't remember any major intestinal complaints. People did get upsets. At that time of year, there's no malaria, as far as I know. Certainly, we never used. We may have had mosquito nets, but we certainly didn't use those on operation. And we certainly didn't use them in the line. So I'm thinking it's the dry season, rather like India. There's no malaria in India during the dry season. And I don't think there was in East Africa.
You were under canvas at Gadaraf, were you?
No. We had a few tents. But the great majority of us were living in the open.
Was that suitable?
Oh, yes. The thing is that in the desert, we'd gradually grown used to living in the open. We started the war in September 39 in the desert, and we had lavish issues of tentage. And gradually they got less and less, until eventually there really wasn't any. And in a dry climate, where it's not never too really hot and never too very, very cold. It was a thing one got quite used to.
Was there any problem from animal or insect pests?
None that I can remember, whatever, no.
So there was no danger?
No.
What kind of a life was it? Was it pleasant or unpleasant at Gadaraf?
It was quite pleasant. We weren't there very long, but of course we didn't know that at the time. My experience of that period of the war, and was really continued throughout all the time I was out in the Middle East, which was 5 years, we were always moving, always moving. We always moved once a month, sometimes more often. And so we didn't expect to stay very long there. In fact, we were there probably a week.
And did you have any contact with the local people?
None at all, no.
Was there any hostilities with the Italians?
No. I knew later, of course, that we were being made ready to attack this place, Galabat. It is where, I beg your pardon, Kassala, which is, in fact, the next town up the railway line from Gadaraf and is in fact very close to the Eritrean border, but we didn't know that at the time. And all we did know was that the Italians had encroached into the Sudan at that point and were actually holding Kassala.
What happened after you moved from Gadaraf?
Well, the Italians withdrew rather precipitously from Kassala, so we were immediately made to move forward and occupy the town, which we then did. We moved to Kassala by transport. There were big transport units, troop carrying units. I think they'd come from South Africa, and I'm almost certain that the drivers were black South Africans, Basutos.
Were you told why the Italians had moved out?
No. We just were told to go and occupy the place, and we did.
What did you find there?
Well, there were a few inhabitants still there, but the great majority of them must have fled into the bush, and it was virtually an uninhabited town. That was about, in fact, I have the date here exactly, the 17th of January. So we must have been at Gadara for about a week.